everybody, and welcome back to Psychedelics Today. Joe Moore here, coming at you from Breckenridge, Colorado. Today on the show, we have Richie Ogolnik, a facilitator of Ibogaine Experiences, who's been at this for about 26 years. And he's now on to some interesting stuff about, you know, right to live, right to die kind of work. And that's a really interesting field too. So he gets into, you know, how and why, how Ibogaine works, why he likes working with Iboga versus Ibogaine. And this idea of, you know, flood dosing versus like a gradual increase in dosing. Yeah. And Richie's been on the show before years ago. And I think he's racked up a whole ton more experience since that first time. And just really happy to have him back. We also get the opportunity to talk about some Osho stuff. I think he was in those circles in the past, probably before stuff went really sideways there. Yeah. And, you know, there is a lot of discussion around the sustainability of Iboga relative to the molecule Ibogaine. And yeah, this is something that we did not really get into too much, but just wanted to remind folks that there are, I believe, conservation issues around Iboga. So, you know, just stay tuned on that. We'll hopefully be able to do some work on that in the future. So yeah, I guess that's it for now. And I hope you enjoy this episode. I think it's pretty broad ranging, but yeah, good stuff. Okay. And in terms of other stuff I want to talk about, we've got Navigating Psychedelics for Clinicians and Therapists starting up on May 20. That's going to be really cool. We have an 8-week program there that's CE approved. We've been teaching it for years. We've got a ton of masterclasses in there. The course, while it is 8 weeks, there's 47 hours of material to work through. You don't need to work through all of it at once. You can just come to the classes and then work through the material later, or you can do some of it way ahead of time. Really, whatever works for you. If you want those CEs, you just got to come to the classes. Don't be late. some APA stuff there. So just trying to stay compliant. You can learn more about that class at psychedeliceducationcenter.com. Some of you might be interested in a recent COVID-19 article we did at our blog. You can find that at psychedelicstoday.com/blog. And that's a good one. It was really stressful to put out, but we thought it was really necessary since so many people are doing group work still all the way through the pandemic, including now. I think, you know, talk to a lot of doctors and they believe that if everybody's vaccinated, then the risk is way, 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 way low relative to a normal group where this isn't the case. And we really break down a lot of thoughts in there, and the whole team worked on it. So thank you, team. Thanks, Michelle and Mike, for all your help with Kyle and I's ideas there. It's a real team effort, and really thankful for both of you helping us. And what else is happening? We're coming up into the high holy days of psychedelia, 419, 420, Bicycle Day, and 420. I love how 420 doesn't really have a name beyond 420. It's good stuff. But yeah, both very interesting days. We might have some special stuff to announce in the next couple days about what we want to do on Bicycle Day, but you know, stay tuned. Not 100% sure. So anything else? Yeah, if you want to help us out, don't have any cash right now, leaving a review on, you know, iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Google, all that really helps us out a ton. Or if you want to leave a small monthly donation, you can help us out at Patreon for as little as $2 a month. And that's at patreon.com/psychedelicstoday. Anything else? Well, that's probably it. And, you know, really the nicest thing you can do, share your favorite blog or podcast with a friend. And that's it. Yeah. Now, any questions, you know, feel free to reach out. Support@psychedelicstoday, I think, is the best email now. And we can answer any questions you have about the class or anything like that. So I think that's it for this intro. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you on the other side. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Psychedelics Today. Today we have on a repeat guest, Richie Ogolnik. Richie, how are you doing today?
Doing fine. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, glad to have you back. It's been years since we've spoken.
Yeah.
And yeah, I really loved our recording back then and just happy to have you back on again.
Thank you.
Yeah. Could you, Richie, describe a little bit about the work you do?
Sure. Well, I work with Iboga, Ibogaine is an alkaloid extracted from a West African shrub, but these days, given that I don't do the actual detox treatments, mm-hmm. but I refer people to individuals that are still working the detox and resetting the person to a pre-addictive state without having to go through the agony of withdrawal by using the granddaddy of psychoactives called Ibogaine. I work with Iboga, which is more of a representation of the whole plan, because I find that with the psychospiritual sessions, psychotherapeutic sessions, people seem to more clearly access the specific intentions, the things they want to explore and work through by using the more of a full representation of the plan. Whereas when the actual addiction interruption treatments are done, the isolated alkaloid, Ibogaine, one of the 13 alkaloids located in the plan, is utilized because this something called neuroibogaine, which is a metabolite that fills up opioid, alcohol, nicotine receptor sites, and that alkaloid doesn't wash out the receptor sites for quite a while, and that helps with the elimination of craving for substances after a person has done like the 36 to 45 or so hour experience, and they've eliminated their physical addiction for, let's say, an opioid. Mm.
Yeah, that's great. So you've got a decent network that you refer out to if somebody's acutely in the mix of the...
Yeah.
Yeah. That's really, really nice. So your work is more like follow-ups after that?
Well, the work that I do is... Yeah, it can be. Yeah. A person who is rid of, like, you know, kind of the outer layer of the personality is where the addiction is located. And if they take advantage of that few month window where they'll literally reset biochemistry after they've been doing, let's say, you know, 300 milligrams of OxyContin or 3 grams of heroin a day, if they actually do the other 50% of the work. So here they're literally placed into a pre-addictive state without having to go through the pain of withdrawal. And there's a certain degree of elimination of craving. However, they're still carrying some of the baggage that brought them to the addiction experience in the first place, usually having to do with an abandonment issue. Mm. Actually, more often than not, with a same-sex parent when they were, you know, somewhere between 5 and 15 years old. That issue needs to be really deeply explored. And if they're really willing to do the work and sit across, usually from a same-sex therapist that they really look up to and admire after the Ibogaine treatment, then in 6 months or a year, they're sometimes really wanting to go deeper beyond the addiction process because that level, that layer of the onion has been peeled off, and then they want to explore some deeper, you know, psychospiritual intentions, which I'm certainly willing to work with them directly. And the process is interesting for me because it's very different than I've ever worked before. And I've been involved working with Iboga for 27 years. And now I spend several hours, often totally contingent upon how many hours the person wants to spend with me clarifying intentions. That is, two specific things they want to explore and work through. Not 8 or 11, but just a couple. And we really go through a lot of family history and dynamics in the family structure and life experiences that allow us to take a clear look at specifically what a person wants to, burn through, work through. Mm. And then during the actual session itself, we start very gradually giving the medicine very gradually, so that even during the first 2 to 4 hours, there's enough medicine administered to explore the intentions with some direction and interaction. And then as we increase the dose, the person no longer is able to interact. And that's when they slip under the covers with their eyes closed in a waking dream state. At this point, so clear on what they want to explore for the second stage with iboga, which is about a 15 to 26 to 30 hour self-reflective stage where a person doesn't sleep at all, but they're in a waking dream state. And there's an unleashing of repressed memories and archetypal vignettes and pictorial gestalts. And there's just a lot of really deep exploration that takes place until they move into the third stage where they're basically, integrating and coming back. So the entire session itself is a 48-hour time frame.
Mm. So I've not watched any sessions on video at all. Like, what does the physicality of it look when they're kind of in the mix? Are they kind of like laying down? Is there a lot of movement, or is it quite variable?
Yeah, well, very often people ask me if they should bring a tape recorder with them. And I say, well, just make sure that it's a voice activated tape recorder, because you may say a few words and then 15 hours later, you may finish the sentence. It's an incredibly quiet and passive oriented facilitation, in that a person is very, very quiet in bed for basically 36 hours. And if they're not in bed, they're lounging in a chair. So there's very, very little externally going on with the way in which I do sessions. Mm. The way that they do sessions in Gabon is different. They've got certain rites and rituals. They crawl under a dozen people's legs, and there's music and there's group interaction. But the way that I do a session is absolutely bare bones. And I don't insist that a person doesn't listen to music, but probably 95% of the work that I do, because I encourage people not to listen to music and to basically just have a quiet space for them, a darkened room so that they can, a private bathroom so that they can just, be in a place of solitude for those 48 hours.
Mm. Well, I appreciate that. So have you had a chance to study in Gabon or like practice there ever?
I didn't.
No. Okay.
I went there. I went to Cameroon several times to find initially iboga, and I really didn't know where to go. And I just literally, the synchronicities that transpired that enabled me to find iboga back in 1993 was really, really interesting and fun, to say the least. But I have friends, many friends that went to Gabon, were initiated by the Bwidi tribe, and came back. And some of them, over a period of years, have shared with me that they understand that that the experience of just being under the covers with one's eyes closed is different and deeper and more profound. And of course, they're still in love with the rituals and with the Bwidi. And I've heard other people say that the forest technology, the music, enables them to go deeper So I've had, you know, different opinions after a person has gone, even several times, and they have a few years to reflect upon their experience in Gabon. I've had different views as to, you know, the differences between the Western model, which I'm doing, and the model in Africa.
Well, that's great. So have there, so we talked 2 years ago, and I'm kind of curious if there's been any kind of developments on safety with Iboga.
In terms of?
You know, the, in particular, the cardiac risk.
Well, doing a gradual protocol and doing like a modest amount, you know, not doing a flood dose where it feels like you're going 200 miles off of a cliff, is like, I'm just not really interested in that level of deconstruction for a couple of reasons. One, for safety, because I work with people in their 60s and 70s, and I also find that people that are older can take less iboga and go very, very deep because they're ready. They're really ready, and they're willing, and they're open. So I've had many people wind up doing a very modest amount, and over a period of 6 or 7 hours, and doing a gradual protocol enables a person to have a safe experience. And as per usual, when a person is interested, they must receive an EKG. And if the EKG indicates any red flags whatsoever in terms of working with iboga, I'll speak with them about it and refer them to somewhere to go where there's, you know, physicians and so on. So I'll only do a session with a person that really has an impeccable EKG.
Yeah, that's great. Do you prefer the EKG to be interpreted by a cardiologist, or do you think a GP is fine?
I send it off to a couple of people, that a doctor and a person that is well versed in reading the EKG. We're looking for specific red flags, like there's the QTC, which is the electrical current that runs through the heart, and we're just wanting to make sure that the QTC is not prolonged, because iboga temporarily prolongs the QTC. But this pertains most often when we're needing to address and overwhelm the symptoms of withdrawal from opioids, because we must give a person more ibogaine so that they don't feel the discomfort of withdrawal. When it comes to the psychospiritual therapeutic sessions, we can do a much more gentle approach. We don't need to flood a person. We can do a small amount over a period of several hours. And this also, you know, ameliorates the symptoms as far as QTC prolonged and so on.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I've been working with iboga personally for 27 years, and I haven't had an incident, which I'm very thankful for, especially during the first several years where I had no idea, because nobody else was working with it in the Western Hemisphere, and I didn't know. You know, I didn't know anything about EKGs at the time. It wasn't until some few years that, you know, I began to have people do EKGs, and we were flooding people with huge amounts of ibogaine. And I guess we wouldn't be having this conversation if something had happened. But I was very fortunate personally, although I know providers that work with addicts, and they had incidences take place. So iboga is something, it's different than any other psychoactive. you know, you can take 5 grams or even 16. Somebody has done 16 grams of psilocybin, and it's, you know, it could take a tremendous amount of, you know, quantities of LSD and so on. And it's not dangerous, but you have to be very, very careful with iboga, and it's very specifically calibrated according to body weight. And I like this very gentle, gradual protocol also because when we flooded people back in the day, the visions, the pictorials came so fast and furious that a person couldn't hold on to a particular subject long enough to really deeply explore it. And now with this gradual protocol, people can, you know, it's a gentler and it's a slower process, even though it's still very intense, and a person still is in that second stage for a very, very long time, but they have the capacity to relax more deeply into the different frames, subject frames that they're receiving, and explore more deeply. So I just really like this protocol for many reasons.
Yeah, in our worldview, like, length of experience is really important and helpful. And I love how you're talking about this kind of gradual increase. Like, you know, I kind of have my doubts about how much work you can really do in, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. But you're giving yourself 48 hours. Like, that's a different game.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, when we flooded a person, the session also lasted for 36 to 48 hours. But the first stage, that first 4 to 6 hour typical psychoactive stage was just so intense. Like, as I mentioned, like you're going 200 miles off of a cliff, but living to talk about it, that kind of thing. And so I've substituted that stage for a more interactive, somewhat directive stage. And then a person still, just like when they were flooded, still slip into that second stage, which actually ends up being the same as it was back in the day when we flooded a person, but they move into the second stage, even more clarified in terms of the intentions that they want to explore. So I've just been really quite delighted with the success, if you will, of people exploring and really receiving the answers to the questions that they've been exploring during the hours of conversation that we have before we actually get together and do the session. And then afterwards, in terms of the integration, I'm very interested in spending as much time as a person wants on the phone integrating the experience, because unlike other psychoactives, it's interesting. It's something, it's almost like you're introduced to a new language. And 6 months, 8 months later, people are sharing with me that their intentions have finally all been worked through. And they're maybe considering doing another session in 6 months or a year. Whereas with other psychoactives, you can, you know, very comfortably do, you know, ayahuasca once a week, once a month, for months or years. People tend to do iboga maybe 2 to 4 times in a lifetime.
Yeah.
Because there's so much integration going on. So I'm really interested in really an unlimited amount of time of just preparation as well as integration, and then during the experience itself, it's basically a one-on-one 48-hour. But I'm very, you know, very, it's a very passive-oriented, as I said, facilitation.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Yeah, this preparation phase is kind of underrated, and I'm glad you're interested
in that. And so is the post
Yeah.
phase. underrated, you know?
Totally.
As people tend to gravitate towards the experience itself. And to me, the experience in a way is overrated. You know, I'm not really a fan of focusing on the experience. I'm more interested in where a person's at 2 months after that session, not reflecting upon, you know, 16 and a half hours of visions that they typewrite to me in 34 pages of description. I'm more interested in what happens, where they're at 2 months or 3 months later in terms of how it affected their lives.
Mm.
I mean, it's great to have a cosmic experience. I'm not saying that it's not, but you know, after a while, you've had enough experiences per se, and it's time to integrate then and to really have the experience be impactful.
Right. How do you deal with? This is a tricky question. It's okay to pass if you want. So I've been trying to struggling with this kind of question a little bit lately. Like a lot of people will say, oh, psychedelics for sure. Like every psychedelic experience is a spiritual experience. And, you know, while that's partly true and partly not true, like how do we deal with, or how do you like to think about that? Like, do you bring spirituality in? Or like, is there some sort of progression of some kind you like to communicate? Or is it mostly like self-directed, like kind of just working with the people's belief systems?
Well,
it's a weird one. All of, sorry.
You know, I mean, it's fine. It's very complex.
Mm.
And yet it's kind of paradoxically very simple. It's just, it's all of the above. It has a lot to do with readiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the person needs to really want to take a look at some deep, deep issues. They can't just want to. They have to want to, you know, and there's a difference. And a person who's 20, you know, is going to have a very different experience than a person who's 40. A person that has done a lot of work, a lot of internal work, is going to have a much deeper, much more profound experience and results than a person that whose propensity it has been to look outside and to look away from their process. I know this just touches like an aspect of the question, but maybe we can break the question up into a couple of different themes so that I can just share as much as I can possibly share about it.
Yeah. Hmm.
Let's see.
Thinking about how to parse this as well. So I guess let's like really specifically psychedelics as a path for spiritual growth. Maybe like that is like one chunk. Like, is there something there? Or is it like psychedelic experience plus a lot more?
Well, so the definition of spiritual, it's like, it, you know.
That's true. I'm going to start with good definition.
I don't see the difference between, there is no spiritual and there's no material. It's all one thing. It's mm-hmm. all one. And if a person's accessing for the first time in their life at 43 years old, that their brother created a tremendous amount of post-traumatic stress because of their relationship when he was particularly somewhere between 6 and 10 years old, that can be construed as a, you know, psychological, insightful experience, but it's spiritual because it's enabling the person to help them get out of their own way so that they could experience not defining themselves so solidly as a separate sense of self and have a sense, a deeper sense of the unity, the unicity of life. So I can't really decipher or separate spiritual with psychological, material. You know, it's like, just reminds me of when I went to New York in 2004 with the idea of creating the underground, because there are some people that just can't afford to go to Mexico or Costa Rica.
Right.
They can't afford to spend the money, and they can't, some people can't even get passports because they have a record. So I went to New York and I invited about 8 or 9 people from all over the country, from Santa Fe to San Francisco, Portland, to come if they had a place to stay in New York, or if they had the money that they could afford to, you know, rent a room at a hostel for a few months. And we ended up distributing brochures and flyers in front of methadone clinics in Harlem. And we ended up doing 40 or 50 treatments in people's apartments in Manhattan. And there was one point where I met a heroin runner down in Union Square. And I asked him if he was willing to call up his dealer and allow us with a film crew to come up to the dealer's apartment so that I can watch him shoot up heroin. Because at that point, it was many years, it was some 5-10 years that I was working with Iboga, but I was never an addict, and I still wasn't, I still didn't understand completely, as much as I wanted to, what the payoff was. Like, why are you shooting up dope, you know? And here I was working with addicts, you know, speaking with their sisters and wives and parents and them day in and day out for years. And I still didn't get the real, I still didn't get it. And people knew that I didn't get it. When they would show up for a treatment with me, you know, some of them would look at me sideways and say, like, who the fuck are you? It's like, I mean, what, you look like you just came from a, you know, from a retreat center and sitting in meditation for 10 hours a day for 7 years. Like, who are you? You know? And it was true. I wasn't really, you know, privy to their really deep angst and experience. And so we were actually allowed to go up to the apartment, and I watched this person shoot up, and he was describing like the warmth, you know, under his tongue and the sense of feeling at home and at peace. And I realized that it was like a satori, that I could relate to. It was like an experience that everyone on the planet is looking for, whether they're, you know, the head of a corporation, or whether they're accumulating spiritual experiences, whether they're accumulating psychedelic experiences. Everyone's looking for that sense of peace and rest. And when I realized that, people, again, when the New York scene was over and I wasn't training these 8 people to do treatments anymore, I finally completely was on the same page. And when people would come to me for treatment, it was like, it was just so much, I understood on a deeper level. And I was ready at that point in my life to really get what it was all about, and not to feel that separation between me and the people that were coming to receive treatment. I trained a lot of paraclinicians and ex-addicts and even a couple of doctors to do sessions through the years. And I always found the ex-addicts to be much more intuitive and, you know, just much more available to do this work than myself and the paraclinicians and the doctors that I helped.
Do you think it's because they lived the experience, they just have more compassion or more like patience, or?
All of the above. Yeah. The compassion, the caring, the dedication. The information, they, you know, they knew what drugs obviated and potentiated, and it was just such a passion because they were giving back after they were clean, and to this day, there's quite a few of them 15, 20 years later, they're still working in different parts of the world.
Mm.
So why did I begin this story?
We're exploring this idea of spiritual, like what is like the interface between spirituality and psychedelics? Maybe.
Uh-huh. Okay.
If that's still not right. Too abstract.
Yeah. I guess we're exploring this question and we're just sort of exploring it by sharing, you know, kind of bits and pieces of work and my opinions.
Yeah.
So, but it's a good question.
Mm. Like from your perspective there about like this underlying unity, you're kind of spot on in terms of like, yeah, like differentiating spiritual life from regular life. For some people, there is zero difference. And, you know, for other people, it's like, you know, when you go to the, your job, you know, you're doing accounting or, you know, selling stuff. Like, how do you make that feel spiritual? I don't know. Maybe that's something like spiritual growth.
Right. That's right. You can't make it feel spiritual. You just, you know, you get to a point where you get out of your own way and then the unicity is an existential condition. It's not even an experience because experiences come and go. It's more of a condition. It's more of an understanding beyond, you know, the understanding that's beyond understanding. Mm-hmm. It's something that the mind can't really grasp. It's something that's that takes some maturing into.
Mm. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, only reason I'm like struggling with this is I was listening to some Kabbalist recently talk, like critiquing the psychedelic world. And I'm like, I don't actually know how to relate to that. Like, it seemed like he was talking more just like, you know, teenagers hitting acid or dropping acid in their basement or smoking DMT in their basement without much. It's just entertainment value. And I think that's what he was like reducing the whole psychedelic movement to that. I don't think that's really valid, you know.
No, there are people like the psychedelics were never my way through.
Mm-hmm.
I was introduced to iboga because I wanted to find something that I can do as an end in itself, not as a means to an end, something that I can do that was bigger than me, you know, a project that I can kind of run alongside and contribute to and just feel a sense of passion. But what I found, like for example, I did LSD when I was about 18.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my first, it transformed me. It mm-hmm. was my first experience of unity. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I'm home. And I tried it two or three more times and I didn't get to that condition again. And I was immediately propelled to do meditation. And a couple of years later, I was going overland to India and I was sitting for a few months for like 10 to 14 hours a day in meditation. And you know, and then through the years, methodologies changed and teachers changed and exploration of the different bodies that we have, mental, mm-hmm. spiritual, astral, ethereal, changed. But that was my way through. And people come to me and they're completely in love with psychedelics. And I totally respect that this is their way through. Just like a Kundalini breath method, rebirthing, holotropic breath work was my way through for many years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, psychedelics are some people's way through. And they just put a tremendous amount of devotion and a tremendous amount of longing and energy and pilgrimage into going within themselves through that methodology, just like a scientist is in love with their methodology. But what I've noticed is if you're in love with the method and stick with it, and every method gets to the same place. Every person experiences, every enlightenment is the same. The expression of it is different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something there. Yeah. Like, I think some people don't ever really engage and they might not get past like second grade, you know? But, you know, when people engage, it's like, you know, you're having a relationship with self. And that alone is a pretty powerful thing. And once you start realizing how big, what's my favorite line here? It's all in your head. You just have no idea how big your head is. Something like that, you know? Like it's kind of comical and like recursive and, you know, really interesting.
Right. Mm. It sure is.
Yeah. And it's wild, right? Like, cause there's so many interesting paths. Like how many, like if somebody wanted to do like an interesting analysis, they could like do kind of a interfaith rundown. So like, you know, try to come up with some sort of metric, right? And like look at Zen practitioners.
Well, yeah. Actually, there's a teacher. Before he passed, I think it was in 1999. His name was Osho, but before that, he called Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh, and through his disciples, they compiled because he talked. He did discourses for 14 years. 287 books, and the books were on Freud and Adler Young, 4 volumes on Jesus, and tons of books on Buddha and Zen and Hinduism. And if you took a look at half of his 287 books, they contradicted the other half, and you were basically left with nothing to hold on to, which was beautiful. Which was brilliant. And yeah, he really did explore. I think that you were kind of mentioning that he really did deeply explore, you know, irrespective of, you know, the Mishigas and the drama. He was quite an astounding individual.
Super prolific. Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's, you know, once you have the right support and if you've chosen to be a guru, it's not that bad of a gig, right? You just have to like expound on, you know, the nature of the universe and suchness. But you have to get there first.
You also
right?
just have to mensch too. You have to, you know, the transpersonal map is very complex and you can have deep, deep non-dual experience moment to moment in your life and still be an asshole. And at the other side of the spectrum, you can be a real mensch. You can be like a lovely human being, you know, with lots of integrity, but you still are so entrenched with identifying with a separate sense of self. So the transpersonal map is very complex and it involves many different aspects of the human condition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I agree there. Just thinking back on Osho, it's like tough to separate Osho, but you know, he was super prolific and he was super influential and still influential today. Like Jim Jones isn't that influential these days, you know? Like Osho made a difference in a lot of people's lives, like people that were there at Rajneesh Param, like still loved it for the most part.
Yeah, when the Rajneesh Param happened, I went into the desert for 33 days and I've just felt really deeply that something was not quite right there.
And you were involved.
I was involved in India in 1980 and 81. Mm-hmm. But when he moved, you know, when he created the commune, when his people created the commune in Oregon, I just felt that something was not right. And I don't think that he was privy of what was going on. I think he delegated like so much responsibility to some people that, you know, basically took over. But in any case,
I appreciate that perspective. Yeah. Like watching the film, the woman Sheila seemed like she was more involved than he was at times. Like he was kind of like the monk that would come out once in a while to do his stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, he had no power. People gave him a lot of gifts.
Mm. Yeah.
And very, very interesting. But anyway.
Yeah. Always fun to talk about Osho. I was running, or I was helping run a breathwork workshop once, a holotropic landscape, and somebody popped in who was deep into the Osho work and was like refusing to do breathwork the way we teach it, and insisted on doing it the Osho way for 3 hours. I was like, this is, never seen this before, but all right, like do what you want to do, man.
Chaotic meditation. Yeah.
Right. It was like very fascinating to watch, at least.
Very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of energy moving. You know, I think there's something there, but
yeah,
you know, how to relate to that, okay. I'm not sure yet.
Going back to finding, there's 100 or so at least methods, and you know, finding the method that, and sticking to the method, and then, and also eventually realizing that the method is not going to get you to it. So psychedelics or iboga or meditation, methods won't get us to that beneficence. What methods tend to do is allow us to crawl back to ourselves and say, I've accumulated all of these experiences through this methodology, but I can't do it. I can't go any further. I have to let go of this method. And then the beneficence really happens.
Right.
So it's running, kind of running out the arrogance of adulthood until you crawl back to yourself and you say, I surrender, like Buddha, you know, surrendered under the tree. Mm. And then it, when you let go, and even when you let go of the one that's letting go, So that's when the beneficence happens, and you're not so much identifying through a separate sense of self anymore, and that's where the peace comes, and the tranquility and the sense of being home, and that's beyond experience.
Yeah. Curious if you can share like an interesting story you've seen with a client, like
I will,
like a dramatic transformation really of some kind.
The most undramatic experience. I'll share it because okay. It was brilliant. It was early on. I was probably doing sessions for 3 years, and I met a woman in her 40s who, since she was 8 years old, always wanted to be a hairdresser. Mm-hmm. And she wanted to teach hair, you know. And she married a guy who was a hairdresser as well. And they both, neither of them wanted to have kids. She was 8 and she didn't want to have kids. She really created a life where she got everything that she always wanted. Mm. And then she gave me a call and she wanted to do iboga. And she wanted to do it and create the quintessential New Age experience where we were looking over the black sands of the Pacific Ocean in Costa Rica, sharing a porch, her husband and her in one room and me next door. And we proceeded to do a session and absolutely nothing happened. Mm. And her goal was to see the pictures. She wanted to see these visions that everybody was talking about under the influence of iboga. And she said it was as if she did a quarter of a Valium. She said it was like the most frustrating, disappointing experience she ever had. And it was probably the only time in her life that she didn't get what she wanted. Mm. So after the session, and here I was, a novice, really still very attached to giving people what they wanted, not necessarily what they needed. And I was in the other room, just like in a total quandary, like, what am I going to do? She's not getting what she wants. Nothing's happening. Why isn't anything happening? You know? And And then her husband and she went on a tour of Costa Rica for 17 days. And when they came back, he gave me a call and he said she was the grouchiest that I've ever experienced her in years. And then they went back to California and she kicked into unity. She kicked into literally witnessing her sleep for 10 months. She was so clear and she was utilizing so little energy to accomplish so much more than she's ever accomplished before. She was like so joyous and so peaceful for 10 months. And I surmise that what happened was that she, through the genius of her interacting with Iboga and created no experience whatsoever, and that enabled her to access a level of frustration, a layer of the onion that she never allowed herself to access before because she always got what she wanted. And somehow she burned through something that she never burned through before, and that kicked her into a much clearer, open state of consciousness. How's them apples?
That's good. Yeah. Like in breathwork, we see that a lot. Like the frustration can come up in session quite a bit. Like how do you, and like that frustration, like making it really big and long, I think it's really helpful.
Well, because of preference and because of desire and because of wanting to have this experience that we think we need, instead of surrendering to realizing that you know, we often get what we need, not necessarily what we want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 That taught me a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's interesting. I never really like factored that into like somebody like, are these people that usually get everything they want all the time, minimal frustration in their day to day that way? Uh-huh. It's a really interesting thing. I'll keep an eye for that once I'm able to do workshops again. Yeah, that's fascinating. And you know, it sounds like from your story, like there was some sticky results there. They seemed to last for a while for this person.
Well, yeah. I mean, she went on for many 10 months. Yeah. And inadvertently, without even going into the session with the intention of exploring why she was smoking pot day and night, she stopped smoking. And that wasn't her intention. But obviously, on some level, it was. So some people, you know, they have specific intentions, but they end up exploring other things that they didn't realize were actually more significant to explore. And other people very clearly explore the intentions that they go into the session with. But the cool thing about setting intentions is not so much the content, but the impetus. You know, you create the pilgrimage to go deep within you, irrespective of what you really explore. But it's a process, and it's a methodology. So during those hours and weeks before, we're, you know, discussing intentions, and we go through, you know, like, again, family history and so on. And that just creates the impetus to go deep, irrespective of what they actually really explore during the session. It's really a setup, you know, it's just a way to go deep. And for years I worked and I never really appreciated the how meaningful it is to do that preparation in a very direct way. You know, I told people, well, 10 days before your session, you know, begin to explore a couple of things you want to intend to explore. But now, during our discussions, it seems to enable people to explore more deeply.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, it's good stuff.
Yeah. Cool. So are you still working with folks like during the pandemic?
I am. Uh-huh. Yeah, I am. And yeah, and people, you know, could, you know, get in touch with me. I like phone, but I know a lot of people aren't comfortable initially with giving a call. So, you know, I can receive emails or texts, but I'm really a phone person, and I don't need a text to ask me when is a good time to call. I just like to receive calls. I'm old school. The way we used to call each other was just simply by picking up the phone and calling. Yeah. And I prefer that way of communicating.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I do love phone calls too. I can barely text an email. I cannot keep up with my email. So right there with you. So Richie, what's your website? If people want to get in touch and learn more.
Thanks. It's ibeginagain.org. I begin again, just the way those three words are spelled, smushed together. ibeginagain.org.
Great. Anything else you want to mention before we wrap up?
I really appreciate our second talk here. It's been different and spontaneous and fun.
Good.
I appreciate the invite and you know, take care of yourself.
Yeah. Thank you.
And others.
Yeah. I will try to take care of everybody. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Richie. And I hope we get to do it again. This has been fun.
Thanks again for the invite. Bye, everybody.
And there you have it, Richie Ogulnik. I hope y'all liked that one. It's really nice. And thank you, Richie, for joining us. This, you know, treating folks struggling with substance use disorder is really hard. And it's a really hard topic to get right. It's something that I think we all know people struggling with various sorts of, you know, use disorders. Doesn't have to be a substance, right? Like things, if we want to call them addictions, there's many sorts of addictions. I think I remember years ago, people in South Korea dying from internet addiction, essentially, like not eating, being at a, you know, computer cafe and just, you know, straight up dying because they didn't eat or drink or, you know, do anything for multiple days in a row. So it's pretty easy to have injury from various disorders like this. So this is a really popular mechanism for treating opioid use disorder. And there's a lot of folks out there with that problem right now. I'm hoping that more drugs come to the table, and that I think MAPS stated their plan after MDMA's mission to complete, which might be a few more years there. They're planning to study a whole plant ibogaine or maybe just ibogaine for opioid use disorder, which would be phenomenal. I don't know if that will actualize, but I hope so. I know there's some big groups out there working on 18MC, and we did a blog on this a while back. So if you want to learn more about that, check out our blog, 18MC Psychedelics Today, and you'll find that. Yeah. So thanks again, Richie. This is a big topic. Glad you were able to help us again. Yeah. So again, we've got a new COVID blog. Check that out on our blog. We've got a number of other articles coming up as well. Rebecca Martinez joined us. We've got some other ones coming from some great folks over the next week or two. And yeah, we're coming into Bicycle Day and 420. So stay tuned for any kind of surprise events we might be helping out with. You know, the Mount Tam integration thing is going on over the weekend. So that's going to be cool. Kyle and I are busy with Philosophy of Psychedelics Conference at University of Exeter, helping out, being facilitators there. And Kyle's been on the actual organizing team a lot. So he's put in a fair amount of time helping there, which is great. Yeah, so a lot of great things happening. Wish there were more seats available to the Exeter event, but it was capped at 80. Otherwise, we would have probably buried you with ads for that one, because it's going to be so cool. I think even David Nutt's coming, which is wonderful. So yeah, again, May 20, we kick off our next cohort of Navigating Psychedelics for Clinicians and Therapists. So if you want to get involved, come on over. We'd love to have you. And I think that's it for now. You can learn more about that at psychedelic education center.com. All right. I think that's really it. So Joe Moore signing off from Breckenridge for Psychedelics Today. We will see you on the Friday episode. Bye-bye.